From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Caroline Kennedy is out on the road campaigning for Hillary Clinton's U.S. Senate seat, and we'll have the latest on Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. He's fighting allegations that he's involved with a scandal to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat. We've got these stories and more with our ace politicos, Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She's an author and nationally syndicated columnist, and Robert Trainum, the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast Naval CN8. I've missed you guys. Haven't talked to you in a while.
Hello, Farai.
So, we miss you, too.
Yeah, definitely. So
I have some mistletoe for you, Farai.
Oh, thank you. Well, I would rather share a dance floor at the inauguration. So.
Okay,
we'll do that.
Stop by my house for some warm gumbo before you go to those parties.
You betcha. My date is my mom, so I hope you stay a little for her, too.
My date. I have actually several dates. My two sisters are coming up and some friends, and so it is going to be one great party in Washington, D.C.
That's right. Wear your comfortable shoes. Don't try to look cute.
Yes, indeed. Speak for yourself.
All right. Well, you're better with that than I am then. Well, okay. Let's dig into this with Senator Hillary Clinton. Her seat is up. Caroline Kennedy is the daughter of President John F. Kennedy. And Caroline Kennedy has spent most of her life shying away from the public spotlight in the way that politicians hold it. So, Donna, why do you think she's interested in holding office at this point?
You know, I'm sure that at some point, Ms. Kennedy got the political bug like everyone else. She grew up with politicians. She is the daughter of a great national statesman, the niece of perhaps one of the best legislators ever in the history of the United States Senate. She is well qualified for this position. I hope she seeks the office. I hope Governor Patterson gives her every consideration. She has been a champion for civil rights, civil liberties, education, health care. Caroline Kennedy would not only bring stature to that seat, she would bring substance.
All right. Do we get a yes or a no on those points from you, Robert?
I think we will get a sort of. And here's why. I mean, first and foremost, she feels inspired. She feels inspired for two reasons. Number one is because, obviously, her uncle is in ill health, and who knows how long he will be with us. Hopefully, he'll be with us for a very long time. But the fact of the matter is, a Kennedy in the Senate is something that the American psyche has been used to now for the past almost 50 years. Secondly, she feels inspired, and she said this herself during the campaign trail, is that for the first time in her generation, for the first time in a very, very long time, she now feels inspired about politics, especially given the fact of her father's legacy. So, you know, is she qualified? Of course she's qualified. Is she probably the best senator that New York could probably have? I don't think so. And the reason why is because New Yorkers are used to these high-profile people parachuting in. We saw this with Robert F. Kennedy. We saw this with Daniel Patrick Moynihan. We saw this. Now, they've all been very, very effective. But I think first and foremost, they should have a New Yorker, a genuine New Yorker who actually runs for the seat, who actually campaigns for that seat, who actually wants that seat. And candidly speaking, maybe their last name should not be Clinton. Maybe their last name should not be Kennedy. Maybe it should be a Brazil. Maybe it should be a Chidea. But the fact of the matter is, maybe it's time for an ordinary person to come in there and clean up the United States Senate.
Do you think that this is undemocratic with a small d, Donna? The idea that, you know, people of great name whose families have great stature should be, you know, obviously she has done many things with her life, but is there the sense that she might be leapfrogging over other people if she goes for this?
Well, you know, there's some merit to that, and there's no question that we live in an age and an era where people would like to see some fresh faces in public office. They will also like to see people who are not so well connected and rich. But on the other hand, if Governor Patterson decides to put Caroline Kennedy in that position, he will make that decision based on what's best for the state of New York. I think people should not underestimate Caroline Kennedy and her unique skills and talents that she will bring to the position. And I think at a time when not only the state of New York, but the country is struggling for new leadership, she would be a breath of fresh air. So, again, I also would like to see more women and minorities serve in public office. And so she fits at least one of those qualifications for me, and that is she is a woman of stature.
I'm going to move us ahead, Robert, to Blagojevich and Jackson. So, just to recap, of course, the Illinois governor he appears to have offered to sell the seat that Senator Obama held when he was, in fact, a senator and not just the president-elect. So there's this House panel launched an impeachment into the corruption case, and Republicans have launched a political ad campaign demanding a special election. There's many different people who want different things here. Why is there no solution if it seems that the position is so tainted?
I think the reason why it's so convoluted is because you have so many dominant personalities that are at play at this, and you also have so many conflicting emotions. The fact of the matter is, and this is all, of course, alleged, the governor is still innocent until proven guilty in a court of law, is that it appears that no one can bring some type of resolution to this, with all due respect to the state of Illinois and to the city of Chicago, but it's my understanding that this is very common in Chicago, where you have a lot of dominant personalities, you have a lot of dominant people at play that have a lot to say and a lot to win and a lot to lose with the Senate seat. It appears to me, this is not just because of my previous background in politics. This is me talking as an American, but it appears that the only way that this can really be cleaned, if you will, is if the American or the Illinois people were to go to the polls and decide for themselves, not the governor, not the state legislature, not a congressman or another senator, but the people themselves go into the polling booth and says, this is who I want as my next United States senator. It should be taken out of the back rooms of the cloakroom, out of the back rooms of the bars and of the legislators, and in the hands of the people. This is exactly what President-elect Obama campaigned on, and this is exactly what the American people deserve and want.
Do you think, Donna, that this state or perhaps all states should move to a special election system?
I think eventually that's probably one of the reforms that we will look at in the coming years as President-elect Obama, once he takes office, would like to bring in an era of accountability and transparency. And I think that is one way to ensure that there are no backroom deals, there's no quid pro quo, or no pay-to-play schemes. And let me just say, look, we have just endured in D.C. over the last 8 years a culture of corruption, and the last thing we need is to send someone to Washington, D.C. that has been tainted by the political process in their particular state. So I think voters at some point will begin to tell politicians that we don't like the current schemes, we don't like the current methodology, how we select our leaders. Select our leaders. And I think voters will demand the kind of change that we ultimately need to bring in more transparency.
All right, Donna, what about Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr.? It came out that he is the candidate number 5, but that doesn't mean that he offered quid pro quo. And by that, I mean there were a list of candidates associated with the investigation into the governor's actions, alleged actions, Governor Blagojevich's alleged actions. One day I will get that right without trying twice. So what's the status in your mind of Congressman Jackson's ability to frame the debate around his role or lack thereof in this?
You know, when you start issuing press releases every other day, things become a little bit murky. After his first press conference, I called him to say I thought he did a great job in laying out the facts and essentially acknowledging that he was candidate 5. Now, with this new revelation that he may or may not have served as a government informant, and then another press release indicating that he did nothing wrong, all he was doing as a public servant was informing federal officials of something that was going on that didn't meet the smell test. I have to tell you, I too am one of those Americans that's waiting for Mr. Fitzgerald to lay out all of the information, to give us a complete account of what happened, and to see the evidence. Right now, it's a lot of innuendo, a lot of hearsay, a lot of talk, but this seemed to be a web that is going to ensnare a lot more than the governor, and it worries me deeply.
From your perspective, Robert, do you see Congressman Jackson being able to have a future as someone who has the chance to be a senator, let alone in this situation, just ever.
You know what, Fry? I don't know. And the reason why I don't know is because, as my grandma used to say, you know, it doesn't pass the common sense test. The common sense tells us is that there's something going on here more than what we currently know. Common sense also tells us here is that the more and more you talk, it seems like the more and more you get into this deeper and deeper hole, as opposed to what Congressman Jackson is saying and what his actions are also alluding to. So the fact of the matter is that we simply don't know. And frankly, there's only two people that really do know, and that's Congressman Jackson and perhaps maybe the special prosecutor. I understand why Congressman Jackson wants to come out and set the record straight. I understand why he wants to make sure that his reputation is not tainted. What I don't understand is why allegedly some of these things are being done the way they're being done. What I also don't understand is how the people of Illinois can sit there and say, okay, I'm going to let the state legislature, or I'm going to let the governor make this appointment. They probably are saying, well, wait a minute. My common sense here is telling me that I want to decide who my next United States senator is. This is the people that need to decide. We, the people, need to decide who our elected officials are, not some backroom governor and not some congressman as well.
This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're back talking politics with Democratic strategist Donna Brazil and Robert Tranum, the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network, CN8. And so, guys, I'm going to move on to the cabinet. President-elect Barack Obama announced some more positions. Former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack for Agriculture and Arne Duncan, new Secretary of Education nominee. He's currently the head of the Chicago Public School System. He supported formation of new charter schools, performance-based pay, increased funding for No Child Left Behind. Let's start with him. Do you have any information, Robert, on what makes him a standout? And also, how are Republicans responding, if you know anything about that?
Yeah, I'm told he's a very dominant personality. He is someone that has very sharp elbows. He is someone that is not afraid to close down schools that are not performing and also hold teachers accountable, which is obviously a good thing. Look, every single parent out there, every single uncle or aunt or anyone that has a child in their life wants teachers as well as schools to be held accountable, and they want to make sure that their children are being able to learn to the best of their ability. What I've also heard from a lot of my Republican sources is that although he does have sharp elbows, Farai, he doesn't have sharp elbows when it comes to the teachers' unions. He walks this very, very fine line of saying, yes, 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 we need more accountability. Yes, 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 we need to have smaller school or classroom sizes. Yes, 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 you know, you need to make sure that you show up on time for school and so forth and so on. But when it comes to the actual accountability with the teachers' union, which in my opinion has had literally a stranglehold on the American education system for the last 30 or 40 years, he has not been as hard-edged as some people would like for him to be. So I guess to answer your question, Farai, it appears that he's a good person, a good school administrator, but only time will tell if, in fact, he's able to do two things. Number one, to make sure No Child Left Behind, the landmark legislation that Ted Kennedy and George Bush pushed through the Senate, is actually funded to its existing levels, but also, two, to make sure that we understand, we respect, but we also rein in the teachers' union, which has been running out of control now for the past 30 years.
Sharp elbows, you mean that literally, because he is a champion college basketball player, and I guess he and the senator can spend some time on the court. Donna, what's your impression of him?
Well, first of all, let me just say that he is in charge of the third largest school district in America. He has improved student performance. Graduation rates are up. He has worked very closely, not just with administrators and teachers, but parents. He's tough. I think he's a great choice. He will help reform the national No Child Left Behind law. He will work with all of the various partners at the table, which includes the teachers' union. And I think he is going to be a terrific Secretary of Education. Margaret Spellen, who is the current Secretary of Education, gave him high marks. And I have every reason to believe that President-elect Obama chose him because he knows that Mr. Duncan can get the job done.
All right, let's take a quick look at Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack for Agriculture. What's that going to do, Robert?
Well, you know, for a long time, the Department of Agriculture has always been on the back burner. But now when we take a look at mad cow disease, when we take a look at organic stuff, and we take a look at sustainable farming, we now know that that agriculture and farming is our very way of life. It's an overall fabric of our way of life. Former Governor Vilsack comes from a agriculture state. Agriculture is the number one issue in about 40 states in this country, believe it or not, in California, in Pennsylvania, in Texas, and so forth. When you take a look at the overall sustainability of agriculture, candidly speaking, Governor Vilsack is a very good choice. And I got to give President-elect Obama credit. He is doing a very reasonable, common sense approach path towards selecting his cabinet, to the point where Vice President Cheney, Secretary Spellings, as Donna said, and a few other folks have said, you know what, this is actually not a bad cabinet that President-elect Obama is putting together. It's moderate to center. It's very, very thoughtful. And more importantly, these are individuals that actually know what they're doing. It appears that they know what they're doing. Only time will tell. But on the surface, it is so far so good.
All right. I want to get to this because, you know, it's just so crazy. I'm talking about Minnesota. Republican incumbent Norm Coleman is holding a razor-thin lead over comedian-turned-politician Al Franken. And, you know, ballots are being recounted, probably massaged and buttered by hand. Who knows what's going on? What do you guys think is going to happen? Donna?
First of all, I think that with the Canvas and Review Board made up of the Secretary of State, two Supreme Court justices, their guiding principle will likely be count every vote. We know that Coleman has more challenges right now than Franken, which means that Franken will likely pick up votes. But, you know, Minnesota is known for their clean election laws, and I have to believe at the end of the day, with so many players at the table, that we will get to the bottom of it, and Minnesota will soon send a senator to the United States Congress.
You know, there's been a lot of talk in countries like Zimbabwe and Kenya about power-sharing agreements. Do you think that, Robert, we could ever have, like, co-senators just sharing one seat, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, like a job share kind of thing?
Well, probably not. And the reason why, obviously, is because we have a constitution that is very clear that every single state obviously gets two United States senators, one junior senator, one senior senator. Donna's right. Minnesota, as liberal as it is in terms of the Democrats just outnumbering the Republicans, it's a very fair system. And I would make the argument that the Democratic officials there have been overly sensitive to the fact that not only do they have fair elections, but they're also being extremely deferential as well as fair to Norm Coleman, who is the incumbent senator. There are roughly about 1,000 disputed ballots between the two, and I have no doubt whatsoever that Minnesota will get it right, and they're doing it the right way. They're taking their time. They're stepping back, and although the clock literally is ticking, the U.S. Senate is scheduled to reconvene on January 3rd. They're saying, we want to make sure that we do this right, and again, it goes back to my original point with Illinois. We want to make sure that the people's voices are heard, and heard very, very clearly.
All right, guys.
I have to agree with Robert. It must be Christmas. We are agreeing on Vilsack and also Minnesota that it will be resolved sometime in the next few weeks.
Farai, it's the whole season in the air, you know, the whole Christmas season, but also too, I did bring a mistletoe for Donna.
Oh, yeah. He's my first love on the Republican side. You know that.
Oh, my goodness. All right. We're going to have to keep it PG-13. And on that note, enjoy the mistletoe. Take care.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Absolutely. We were talking to Democratic strategist Donna Brazile and Robert Trainum, the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network CN8. They both joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington. By now, you've heard the news. NPR has decided to cancel News and Notes as part of a network-wide series of budget cuts. Our broadcast, final broadcast, is scheduled for 3/20, March 20th. Our web producer, Jeffrey Bennett, is here to share some of what you've been saying online since last week's announcement.
Hey, Farai. So we received a couple hundred comments on our blog, our Facebook page, and NPR.org. The reaction ranges from shock to outrage, and there's some indifference mixed in there as well. There's even a special Facebook group called Save Farai Chidea, started by a listener in St. Louis named Rowena McGreki. The group now has about 400 members. And our bloggers and regular guests have taken to the web as well, especially Jasmine Canik. She started an online petition and then wrote an op-ed for today's New American Media, which can be found online.
Yeah, I have to say the amount of just the outpouring, it's sometimes hard to know how to respond because mm-hmm. You don't want people to be like, well, just think about yourselves. But it's like, you know, just do think about yourselves. Think about what public media means. You know, right. This is a public trust. And we're here because of you. We're here because everyone who's listening to this show is part of a public trust in American democracy. And so with that spirit, you know, I take the kudos personally, but I also take them as a sign of belief that this is something that we're invested in. You
Indeed.
Know?
And on that note, let's get to some of what our listeners had to say, shall we? So Kyle Smith writes, as a person of color and a news junkie, I've really come to depend on this show to offer more of a rounded view on current events. The show was truly a lifeline for me during a day that is color deprived. And Sharon O'Shaw, just to give some indication of the kind of listeners we have, says, I'm a white 40-year-old woman, and News and Notes is the only window I have into the perspective that it offers. In my white suburban world, all I get of black perspective is MTV and the Philadelphia City News. It's refreshing to tune into News and Notes and see other sides of the culture. Isn't that what public radio is all about? Giving voice to different types of people so we can all appreciate each other. And as you said, you know, some kudos for you too. Aaron Coleman says this, I absolutely love me some Farai Chidea. Somebody find her a venue. Journalists of her caliber need voice because ears are starving.
And that's beautiful.
Yeah. And we also have some response from listeners who want to know what they can do to help. Monica McClendon asks, can you guys move to a less costly area? The South has all kinds of options. So I don't know about starting the day with a biscuit and some sweet tea, but...
not a bad option.
Not a bad option, but, you know, the decision as it stands is final. We also got this from a reader named Matthew Scallon. He says, I can't say this surprises me. Why should we expect anything else from NPR shows not produced in D.C. with the standard content and delivery we've come to expect? Of course, two other problems still remain. One is that the funding model for NPR doesn't allow online, podcast, satellite, or overseas listeners to contribute. Second is a problem facing all of public radio. The audiences are getting older, and their children haven't picked up the public radio habit. And then Lindsay Saunders writes this, I've been listening to News and Notes since middle school. Where will I get my black journalistic inspiration from now?
Well, yeah, we're working on it. We don't have an unlimited mandate here, but we're trying to figure out ways to extend that mandate. It will not happen, as far as we know. Management has been very clear this show will not continue past March 20th, but it ain't over, you know?
Indeed.
I believe that. All right. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Farai.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. He joined me from the studios of NPR West. Now that we have got to our bloggers roundtable, some of the hot topics folks are talking about online are fashion accessories. A little too big to put in a handbag, but certainly not too big to carry one. We are talking about black people. Black people are this year's most fashionable holiday accessory. And should Jesse Jackson Jr. bow out of contention for the Senate seat in Illinois. With us today to discuss black folks reviled and uplifted, we've got self-described vigilante pundit Baratunde Thurston. He writes for Jack and Jill Politics under the pseudonym Jack Turner. He also blogs for sites including the Huffington Post. Arlene Fenton runs the blog Black Women Vote. Her new blog is Black Women's Network. It's going to be up next month. And pop culture and urban living writer James Burnett of the Miami Herald has a blog called Burnetticut. Hi, everybody.
Hey, hello.
Hey, Farai.
So let's talk about black people as the bestest holiday accessory, Gawker, which I admit is one of my it's one of my awful pleasures. A tipster inside a New York PR firm said that clients are demanding more, quote, worthy black folks be added to guest list for their upscale holiday parties. Barack Obama's election makes black people just that much cooler, and they actually did go through a list of socialites and you know, tastemakers like artist Kehinde Wiley that they thought would make good gift basket or gift list accessories. I mean, James, you've been blogging about this. What do you think?
Farai, I was not sure how to react to this at first. My first reaction actually was, why am I not on one of these lists? And then when I saw that it was socialites, I pretty much understood that right away. But the most fascinating thing about this to me is the reaction from some of my readers. They immediately politicized this and made this an issue of, you know, the election of a Democrat means that liberal elitists, in their words, in some of my readers' words, are going to come out of the closet and start embracing black people in a way that they've only pretended to in the past, which completely baffled me.
I mean, do you guys take this, Arlene, do you take it seriously or do you take it as a snarky joke or both?
I'm not taking it seriously. I think I'd wait to see who's really showing up at these parties. I mean, these types of events have never been anything I've been interested in. But even if I was, I would be more offended if black people were kept out rather than being invited for the wrong reasons. Most of the times in those events, everyone is extremely shallow anyway. Even the white people who are invited for the wrong reasons. So, I mean, why should we be any different when it comes to that?
Baratunde, is it the wrong reason, though? I mean, having lived in New York for many years and being much more connected to how money moves in New York than I am in Los Angeles now, you can see, okay, you create a guest list that has these people, you publicize the guest list, then you get the paying customers to come. Like, New Year's Eve parties are just the biggest ripoff. You know, you get one celebrity to scoot through and do a midnight toast, you pay them $250,000, everybody else pays $100 at the door. I mean, is it really silly to think of this kind of strategic guest listing?
Well, that's why I don't plan to be in New York for New Year's Eve. I think it shows a really outdated mode from this publicist community now that they're just catching on that black people are cool. Black people have been cool since we got here, and it's taken them a couple of centuries to catch up on that fact. The one thing that really stood out to me, though, was this idea, this photo op kind of idea that, oh, if we just have black faces, reminded me of Bush's reelection when he had all these pictures on his website. They were all with him and black people that he's never really connected with as well before. And I just have a warning to those socialites. Like, what happened shortly after those photos is we had Katrina come up and you kind of saw the real color. So this whole fashion industry thing next year might be completely gone. You'll find yourselves in a lot of outdated clothes.
All right, James, are you going to try to move up the ladder this year while black people have an open window into the world of high finance and fashion?
It all depends on what sort of free food and drink are being offered at these parties, but no, seriously.
If there's scramps, you're on. If there's no scramps, you're not showing up.
No scramps, then I'm not even going to consider it.
There is a problem with black people as physical objects and accessories, which, I don't know, just something in my genetic profile objects to that sort of objectification.
All right.
I do agree with that. It's a huge expansion on the I have a black friend thing.
All right, guys. Well, this is a perfect place to take our first break, because now that we know our worth, we can meditate about it over the break. We're going to have more of you guys coming up next. Plus, Christmas budgets are tighter these days, so how to let the little ones down easy. We've got our favorite emotional genius, Judge Lynn Toler, sharing her wisdom. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're back with our bloggers roundtable. With us, we've got Arlene Fenton, who runs the blog Black Women Vote, pop culture and urban living writer James Burnett of the Miami Herald. His blog is Burnetticut, and self-described vigilante pundit Baratunde Thurston. He blogs for sites including The Huffington Post. So I want to go ahead and talk about the Blagojevich Obama seat, Jesse Jackson Jr. situation. U.S. Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. has been put in the spotlight. He acknowledges that he is the so-called candidate number five, but that is counter to some reports that he did not offer cash or favors for the Senate seat. There's no evidence that he offered to grease Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich's palm in return for the seat, but there's a continuing probe into the allegations. And it's obviously taking a huge toll on everyone watching this. In a recent interview, CNN's Don Lemon said to Jackson outright, "Your name is being dragged through the mud." Jackson's response was emotional.
"I've got a great name given to me by great parents, and I've got a great father who has a great legacy of public service. And I named my son Jesse. So I'm fighting now for my character, mm-hmm. and I'm also fighting for my life, and I'm fighting for them, and I'm fighting for them, and I'm fighting for them. This is about my children being able to Google their name in 5 years, and there'd be nothing there associated with it that suggests anything wrong.
Baratunde, those mm-hmms are coming from his wife, who was also present at the interview. What comes up for you when you hear that?
Well, first of all, anyone's going to lose the Google battle. If he's ever picked his nose, that's going to be on YouTube somewhere, so he can't run on that sort of defense. I'm taken back to a moment at the DNC where I saw Biz Markie performing, and he said, if you don't want drama, vote Obama. And unfortunately, the shenanigans of the Illinois governor have really added a layer of drama to the votes needed in the Senate, to the governance of that state, and to an edge of the Obama administration as pushed by a lot of his conservative critics. So far, Jackson Jr., we've got evidence that he's actually been cooperating with the prosecutors on another but somewhat related case, and there's nothing that seems to tie him directly, but it muddies the waters for an already sort of edge case for him to be able to be that senator in the first place. It's not pretty, and I hope he escapes all right. There's a lot of love for him, at least among our readers.
James, there's a totally different angle that someone brought up to me today that I'd never thought of before, is that some people might say, well, if he's cooperating with authorities, you know, who knows if he's an informant? You know, people get, there are 12 million layers of paranoia in this world. Probably, you know, 2 or 3 million are justified, but still, right. Some people have this other idea that you should never talk to the government, ever. You know, even if you're in the government. Do you think that's going to come up?
You know, it already has a little. He made the distinction, I believe, yesterday that he had been an informer, but he was not a formal informant. So it's already obviously causing him a bit of nerves. And I can't say that I blame him. The shame of it is, if I could make an analogy, it's like the school children who don't want to brag about being smart. The fact that he may have cooperated with the government, some people are going to hold that against him. So I don't blame him for being a little nervous about how that's parsed in the media.
Arlene, what should we take away from this as it pertains to the era we face ahead? You know, for example, this did not start, this investigation did not start in the age of Obama, but it is part of the dawning of the age of Obama. How much is there going to be a reckoning and an accounting for politics as usual during the first, say, 100 days of this new presidency?
I think we're going to see a lot of it because people are in pain. We're in an economic crisis. We all want someone to blame. And I think that if there is a time to keep your nose clean, this is the time. Going back to Jesse Jackson Jr., I think if he's innocent, he absolutely must defend his name. And I'm actually surprised that some people would call for him to kind of skulk off into the darkness. I think we need more people of integrity to be at the forefront. But if there is any hint of impropriety, maybe he really should try to quiet it down a bit. But I'm just not getting that feeling from him.
One of our commenters on Jack and Jill politics, BTX, proposed it, which I think is the best solution, which is governor steps aside, somebody appoints the Iraqi shoe-throwing journalist to the Senate seat. He's clearly shown a penchant for standing up to President Bush, which I think is a qualification enough.
All right. Well, speaking of journalists with beef, in this case, we're talking about bloggers and sadly, some who have found themselves behind bars. There's a recent report by the Committee to Protect Journalists. It found that more bloggers are in jail today worldwide than journalists from what people call the mainstream media. A majority of arrests were made in China, Cuba, Burma, Eritrea, Uzbekistan as the top five. And so we're not talking, by and large, about, you know, U.S. journalists who we very often are protected compared to journalists around the world. But there is a sense that bloggers are taking risks by putting out information, and that is what journalists do, is put out information. Baratunde, does this show that blogging is both journalism and also that it is something where we need a structure to champion people who are taking risks?
Yes and yes. And the idea that, you know, the way they categorize these journalists slash bloggers slash online media proponents is increasingly less relevant. It's like calling someone a print journalist in 1820. At least that's the era we're approaching. What I found most disturbing as I looked through some of the layers of the report were the spike in arrest really happened after September 11th. And I think a lot of these governments around the world, the more repressive ones, were emboldened by America's own response, pushing rules aside, declaring an endless global war on terror, which kind of diminished the role of constitutions or rights, human rights of any sort. So that was a bit troubling that, you know, another consequence and collateral damage of our effort to defend our freedoms was to, in fact, clamp down on the freedom of the press, which is a core part of that around the world.
Do you ever think, Arlene, that we in the states who blog are not only less protected, but perhaps in some ways less serious about what we do? I mean, not that there aren't fun blogs everywhere, but that people have not reached the point where blogging is a high-risk occupation, the way investigative journalism can be. And should people take more risks?
I definitely think they should take more risks. You know, there was a point in my when I first began blogging where I had to decide whether or not I was going to give my real name, because many bloggers are able to hide behind a cloak of anonymity. And I think that is a great protection, but it also does begin to limit you in how many spheres that you can spread your message. So I think that the more bloggers who kind of come out from behind that computer and begin to speak out for those who can't speak for themselves, the more targeted they're going to be. I think I've met quite a few bloggers in the last year, and they are very serious about what they do. I think every bit as serious as what we consider a traditional journalist. And I really think that we're going to see a little more respect, for lack of a better word, in the U.S.
All right, well,
of blogging. Mm-hmm.
We have to end it there. Always great to have the three of you with us. Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Arlene Fenton from the blog Black Women Vote. Her new blog is called Black Women's Network and is going to be up next month. She was at Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia. Baratunde Thurston blogs at the Huffington Post and Jack and Jill Politics. He was at our NPR New York studios. And pop culture and urban living writer James Burnett of the Miami Herald blogs at Burnetticut. He was at member station WLRN in Miami. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. Parents never want to let their kids down, but this holiday season, many parents face a sad reality. Empty wallets will mean fewer presents. So how do you talk to your kids about facing a lean holiday season? We pose that question to our regular News and Notes contributor, Judge Lynn Toler, the star of TV's Divorce Court. Hi, Lynn.
How are you, Farai?
I'm doing quite well, but there are a lot of folks who are really financially pinched, and for better or worse, we live in a society where people are often judged by things, and kids are no exception. Kids can be really cruel if you're wearing the wrong brand of sneakers, or if you got a toy, but it's the generic toy as opposed to some, you know, overpriced brand name toy. Given how kids act, and given the realities of the moment, and given that gift giving is a part of the holiday season, how do you, if you're a parent, process the needs that you have to deal with the very real bills and to deal with the expectations of little people?
Well, I have a couple of responses to that. First of all, you give the hit to the persons or the people best able to take it. We as parents, my husband and I may not exchange gifts this year. We may exchange coupons for, I'll give you a coupon for go a Crash and Smash movie with you. I'll give it a trick, a chick movie with you. Parents can take it. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
One year I gave my husband a coupon to allow him to smoke a cigar in the house during the game. We were having a tough year that year. So, you know what I mean? So there are things we can take it. So we cannot spend on each other and still encourage our relationship, and it gives you an excuse to be even closer because it makes you come together. And it all, when you talk to the children about it, it's all in how you sell it. It's not, mommy doesn't have enough money this year. It's, you know, this year we're going to do something different. We're going to buy one great thing. It's going to be a Wii game or whatever, and we're all going to play it, and we're going to spend our time doing this, or I'm going to give you a coupon of sorts to do something one day off of school. My 16-year-old would love that better than anything else in the world. I'm just going to give you a one day off school coupon. So it's all in how you sell it. Not that we are without this year. It's just we're changing our game plan this year.
Do you think that kids panic when they get the sense that their parents are in hard times?
No doubt about it, kids panic. Kids are scared to death. You are their whole world, and they think that you're strong. Mommy and daddy can do anything. They'll protect you from everything. And when they see that you are weak, they get scared because you are their everything. So it's very important to keep that to yourself, and it's very important for you two to talk about it so you can assuage some of the angst by talking to one another and not spreading that around. So it's an idea of it's not a tight Christmas, it's a different Christmas. Maybe we'll go to a soup shelter and feed people. So we can do what we always say we want to do, make it about the reason for the season as opposed to the economics or the materialistic standpoint.
Sometimes people have things that they fall back on that are healthy or unhealthy. Some people I know, when they become incredibly stressed out, become gym rats, and they're always exercising, and they actually are in the best shape ever when they're stressed out. Other people overeat, turn to alcohol, other things. And a lot of us live also in extended families where you can tell when someone's doing better or worse. How do you have a conversation if you think someone during a holiday season is kind of going in a direction that's not healthy for them or their family?
Are you all right is a wonderful question. It's something that everybody's afraid to ask, and it's not, are you okay? And if you don't think they're okay, I said, I'm worried about you because I see you doing A, B, and C, and then always have an offer. If they are stressed out because of A, B, or C, if the kids are saying, can I take your kids for a while? Can I help with this? Can I help with that? Can I get involved? Can you get others involved, the whole family, to come together to assist that person in whatever way you need? I think a lot of women sometimes say, we've got to be perfect. We've got to do the right thing. I can't share my need. Share, and you'd be surprised at what you get back. And on the male side, they're often money, money, money. I am responsible. I am responsible. Share your concern with your wife about your inabilities, and you'll be surprised at the ease that you feel simply by having that conversation. Baby, I'm worried. And go from there.
And what about if you see your community in need? Maybe there's more people losing their houses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you're not a bottomless well of money, but you want to help. How do you help?
You help by giving of your time. If someone needs to take on an extra job, or if you have someone in the community, I have someone next door to me who is ill, and I go over there, I'll do laundry. I will do, you know, whatever it does to take the edge off of it. And it's amazing if you just take little chores off of people who are having big problems, the sense of relief that they have, babysitting for people who need to go out and take an extra job, whatever you need to do. But the small things count so much because I think we have such a great sense of isolation in this society. It's our family, it's our problem, and we don't go beyond ourselves to assist and lend a hand, and it is more than money. And I think if we can break down that sense of isolation, there is comfort in simply community that has nothing to do with a bank account.
Oh, it's a beautiful way to put it. And there's going to be, I think, a lot of people bringing their best community spirit to the table this season. And so I certainly offer you mine, and good wishes to you and yours.
And it's the same to you.
Thank you. That was TV's divorce court judge, Lynn Toler. She's also the author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. And she spoke to us from KESZ in Phoenix, Arizona.